Well, we were saying a little bit earlier, we're beginning a new series today called Surprised by Love. It's a study or an exploration of the Gospel of Mark. And, just in terms of what we prayed for then, I think it's fitting that we're looking at the life of Jesus as one who was expected to conquer and triumph and be an empowered leader who would overcome the Roman Empire with force, but actually came with love and came rather than just to win the battle, came to win the war, if you like, the much bigger issue of the human condition and the problem we have that of fear and hatred that divides us and keeps us from one another and from a beautiful understanding and a beautiful full experience of life itself. So let's just go into that first verse again, the beginning of the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. And this is a really courageous way to start off the gospel because, as I said earlier, here's the author saying, okay, Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the Christ. In the Greek language that this was written, it says Jesus is the Christos. Jesus is the Christ. That's the Greek word for anointed one. And Mark is going to show, or the author of Mark is going to show us how Jesus is the Messiah in this really surprising way. Today, I just want to give a little bit of introduction. We're going to sort of dip into different parts of the book as a whole to try and illustrate some of the themes. Essentially, what I want to do is just give a little bit of background, some context, and then we'll look at some of the overarching themes, some of the sort of narrative themes in the story that the author tells. And then we'll look at some ways we can apply that into our own lives. And perhaps, you know, for today, more looking ahead, thinking about, okay, what are some of the lenses we can look through as we read this text together over the next few weeks. Let's look at, well, first of all, the author I've mentioned, it's called the Gospel according to Mark, but like all the Gospels, it was actually written anonymously. It wasn't associated with anybody called Mark until decades later. The actual manuscript, the earliest manuscripts are anonymous. So it's a book full of mystery in many respects, including who wrote it. There are different opinions, especially in ancient times, about who the Mark person was that it has become associated with. There's different characters called Mark in the Christian scriptures. So I don't think it's really worth getting into it. It's just most scholars would agree we don't really know who wrote it. It was probably written around the 60s in the first century, so in the Common Era. It's probably written at a time when the early church, the early followers of Jesus were being persecuted, possibly persecution by the Emperor Nero. It's probably written around the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, which was in AD 70. So sort of that 60s, late 60s, maybe. Again, we don't know for sure, but it's I think, relevant to think that this book, which has so much about the suffering of Jesus, might have been written to a community or for a community that itself was suffering. So there's some, I think, important context there. It was probably written outside of Palestine. Whoever the author is doesn't assume that people would understand the Jewish customs of the day. There's lots of explanation about those, explanation about the geography of the place. Even some of the language that's used suggests that it was written outside of Palestine. So, probably the dispersed community of early Christians somewhere in the Roman Empire, probably experiencing some oppression, some persecution. Lots of different theories about that. So I won't belabor that point, but there's a little bit of context there. What I'd rather focus on a little bit, though, is the literary context. If we think about this as a piece of literature, this book, so we're sort of looking at the big picture of the book here. And that word gospel, so I want to focus on four things here. That word gospel is, that's when it, in the first verse, it says the good news about Jesus, the Messiah. That word is often translated gospel. Gospel means good news, euangelion in the Greek. And what we have here then is the author, and I'll call the author Mark for the sake of convenience, okay, just because we're talking about the gospel according to Mark. What Mark is saying at the beginning there is, here's the beginning of the good news. Here's the beginning of the story of Jesus. But also, in some ways, Mark is, for the first time, because we believe this to be the first gospel written, most scholars would agree on that, and Matthew and Luke kind of used Mark to write their more expanded versions of the good news. But we have the first example, piece of literature that we would call gospel. So the gospel is the good news about Jesus, but it's also the gospel of Mark, right? It's a piece of literature. And it's pretty unique. Because it's not biography, it's not history, you know, it's not written that way. Almost certainly what Mark did was took oral traditions and stories that have been shared around in different areas of the places where Christianity had spread to, stories about Jesus, and is using some, probably not all, of these stories and organizing them in a certain way to make a certain point. He's got an agenda. And so we're going to sort of look at that agenda as we go through each week. But, you know, just the fact that he opens up by saying this is the good news about Jesus the Christ. And then shortly after that, he starts talking about John the Baptist. No birth narrative, no introduction or anything like that. That, you know, you have to assume that the audience kind of knew something about Jesus already. There are these stories out there already. And Mark is putting them together in this genre called gospel. It's not just a biography of Jesus. It's not just historical data. It's not written like history. It's written in this new way, which we've come to call gospel. And it's unique. So there's aspects to it that are similar to other literature. So there's, for instance, a lot of people have compared the Gospel of Mark to some of Homer's writings, particularly the Odyssey. When you look at some of the stories, it's actually really interesting when you look at how the story is told. There are some similarities, and it may be that the author is kind of remembering Homer or sort of using that way of storytelling. There's parts of Mark's gospel that are what's called apocalyptic literature, chapter 13, for instance. And in fact, you could say the whole book in many respects is an apocalyptic. If we think about apocalyptic literature as the sort of the raging battle of good against evil in a very metaphorical sense, not apocalyptic literature isn't meant to be taken literally, but it's a sort of dreamlike genre of literature that portrays the forces of good and evil at battle with one another. So there's some parts of it that aspects to Mark's gospel that, you know, you can find in other literature. Some of the biographies, for instance, of the Greek philosophers, you know, he's almost certainly sort of borrowed from some of that tradition. But put together, it's something very unique. It's one aspect about it that is unique is that it's written in very colloquial Greek. So these sort of the writings of that time tended to be in High Greek, if you like, classical Greek. But this is written in Koine Greek, which was the colloquial Greek, and it's not even very good Greek. Actually, I was saying earlier that Matthew and Luke probably had Mark as a source, and it looks like they sort of corrected some of the Greek or improved some of the Greek when they used it. So Mark's Greek isn't all that great. And that caused it to actually be looked down upon for centuries. I mean, really up until about the 19th century, this gospel was viewed as sort of the inferior gospel. In fact, Augustine in the 4th and 5th century said, his view was that Mark was just a condensed version of Matthew. In other words, a sort of, you know, gospel for dummies kind of thing. You know, it's the shortest one. But that's all changed, though. But the nature of the Greek was a reason to question that. And some of the grammar seems not at its best. So again, it was kind of looked down on. However, that opinion has changed a lot in scholarly circles. The understanding now would be that actually, yes, the Greek's not fantastic, although it did pioneer a way for other people, not just religious writers, but other people to start writing in more colloquial Greek. So it was unique in that respect. It was groundbreaking in that sense. But this issue of narrative technique, that Mark is an absolutely brilliant storyteller, and I think we're going to see that as we work through it over the next few weeks. For instance, Mark changes tenses all the time, sometimes inappropriately, so starts talking about, you know, they were walking along, but, you know, in the past tense, they were walking along the road together. And then suddenly they're arguing and they're talking about who's the greatest. And, they, you know, and it's, it switches to present tense. And for years, people thought, oh, that's just really bad grammar. That's just terrible. But maybe it's incredible storytelling. You know, maybe it's vivid, engaging storytelling. And it's, you know, that's certainly the direction that I would lean in regarding this, because what we see is this very rapid, quick fire scene changing to scene, changing to scene. And that wasn't how you did it back in that day. Like the classic Greek writers loved sort of, you know, just a slow letdown from one part and then a, you know, introduction to the next part. It was all smoothed out and flowing nicely. Whereas, as we're going to see, Mark is chopping and changing and put scene after scene after scene. But those, the juxtaposition of scenes and the suddenness of the scenes means Mark is making a point without having to make the point. We saw that brilliantly a couple of weeks ago when Wesley showed us in chapter 9, if you remember this, about the scene of the person trying to cast out demons, or who is casting out demons. They say, oh, we need to tell Jesus, we'll stop him because he's not one of us. And then they move on, and then there's an argument about who's the greatest. And before it has been a scene where the disciples were trying to cast out a demon themselves, but they couldn't. So you put all these scenes together, Mark doesn't have to then editorially or as an author say, and what this shows is that they would, you know, they didn't get it. They didn't understand Jesus. It's just obvious because of the juxtaposition of the scenes. Really, really great storytelling. Again, we're going to see that as we go through. Now, what happens after that first verse is we get a quick fire introduction to Jesus. So this is the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. There's no birth narrative, which is really significant, right? Matthew and Luke start off with, here's why Jesus is the Son of God, because Mary conceived as a virgin. That's so, you know, we've already got this sort of Greek kind of gods. I mean, I'm not saying this is how it all happened, but you know, it's like gods mating with humans and having this sort of demigod or a godlike human. Mark's not even interested in that, and maybe didn't know the tradition of Jesus's birth, maybe hadn't heard those stories, or just either did and chooses not to include those. So that's not significant. What's significant is this story starts, and then we have John the Baptist, who we're told comes like the prophecies had said he would come. So there's a sort of a link back to Hebrew scripture to say, okay, this is the beginning, but it's linked to the past. John the Baptist comes on the scene. Jesus gets baptized. We'll read that passage in a second. And then Jesus goes out into the desert, and it's just a couple of verses in Mark. He's tempted or tested by the devil, and he's with the wild animals, and the angels are there, and has this sort of apocalyptic feel. There's that sort of battle of good against evil. And then Jesus kind of overcomes in that situation, comes back to civilization, if you like. And it says, when John was put in prison, Jesus started preaching. So his ministry starts. That's the first 15 verses. When John was put in prison, has this sense of foreboding about it because John is eventually executed. So right at the beginning, there's this sense of darkness hovering over the story. And that's really remains there because this story is a story about the fact that Jesus is going to suffer, because Jesus is going to choose love rather than violence as a way of winning the day. And that's going to result when you love, when you're committed to love, it means sacrifice, it means suffering, it means loss. And Jesus is prepared to do that. Jesus is prepared to live that way. But that's the surprise, right? That's not what was expected. Okay, let's look at some of the overarching themes. So the way the story is told, we get Jesus as a powerful, authoritative Messiah and Son of God. Okay, so the author is telling us as the reader, look, here's why Jesus is the Messiah. Here's evidence that Jesus is the Son of God. And it's, you know, the miracles, the casting out of demons, you know, and demons seem to be the sort of symbolic of evil and Jesus defeating evil, all kinds of different miracles, but also the way Jesus teaches. Here's an example of what it says in chapter 1. Verse 22, I think it is, if you can put that one up. The people were amazed at his teaching because he taught them as one who had authority, not as the teachers of the law. So we all we get this sort of tension with the Jewish authorities, with the religious authorities introduced right at the beginning. But they were amazed at his teaching. So Jesus is this powerful spiritual leader, if you like. Now, however, he's totally misunderstood. So we, the reader, we're being told all these things about Jesus, and no, or very few people seem to get it. There's an irony in that the people who are misunderstanding seem to be the people who really should understand. It's like the people who are on the inside turn out to be outsiders, it seems. So let's see some examples of that. So who doesn't understand who Jesus is? Well, the religious leaders don't understand. And that's not surprising to us because we've spent centuries berating the religious leaders of that day, right? But if Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, the promised one, you would expect the religious leaders to be, here's the Messiah, but they don't get it. Here's what they say about Jesus. And the teachers of the law who came down from Jerusalem said, he is possessed by Beelzebul, by the prince of demons, he is driving out demons. So they just think he's crazy. They think he's nuts. They don't understand him whatsoever, even though he's doing all these amazing things. Who else doesn't understand Jesus? Well, Jesus' hometown, where he grew up, they don't get him. Here's what it says when he goes back to his hometown. Jesus left there and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things? And you almost think, they're going to get it. But then it goes on. They asked, what's this wisdom that has been given him? What are these remarkable miracles he is performing? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. So they don't get it. And they're sort of jealous, perhaps, or they're offended that he's such a great teacher. It's sort of a bit weird, but there's misunderstanding. Who else doesn't get Jesus? Well, Jesus's own family don't get him. Here's what it says about that. Then Jesus entered the house, and again, a crowd gathered so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat. So this is pretty intense, right? There's all these crowds. I mean, Jesus is maxed out. When his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said, he is out of his mind. Now, what's really interesting here is a few verses later, they actually show up at the house, his family, and one of the people who shows up is Mary. Now, again, we go back to where there's no birth narrative in Mark's gospel, right? Because if there had been a birth narrative, you would be surprised if Mary thinks he's out of his mind, right? Because angels told her what was going to happen. She conceived supernaturally, et cetera, in the Matthew and Luke stories. But obviously, it's as though Mary in this story, and Jesus' family, have no idea about any of that. They're just seeing Jesus, their brother or their son, acting in a way that to them seems like he's out of his mind. So his family don't even get him. And then who else doesn't get Jesus is Jesus' disciples. We'll see that time and time again through stories. Let's look at one of them. Jesus was in the stern sleeping on a cushion. This is when the famous story of Jesus calming the storm. The disciples woke him and said to him, teacher, don't you care if we drown? He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, quiet, be still. Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. A miracle. He said to his disciples, why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? They were terrified and asked each other, who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. Now, I could get being terrified. They're terrified of the waves, but they're also terrified when the waves go away, right? It's like, who is this? But that's the question. Who is this? They don't really seem to get Jesus. Another example of that would be when Jesus walks on water. It's kind of a storm going on. He appears to them walking on the water. He climbed into the boat with them and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. So Jesus had performed a miracle and they just didn't understand it. It's full of misunderstanding, right? So they just don't get it. Who does get Jesus? There are some people who know who Jesus is. In Mark's account. First of all, the author and the reader, right? What do we just read in the first verse? The beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God, right? So we, right off the bat, we know because we've been told by the author who also knows, in the way the story's written, okay? So we've got to remember that what we're reading about Jesus is what somebody is letting us know about Jesus, right, through a certain lens. It doesn't necessarily define Jesus, but we're going to look at this story for what the story says. So the author and the reader know. God and Jesus know, right? Because let's look at the baptism story right at the beginning. I mentioned earlier, at that time, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. This is right in the beginning of the story. Just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descended on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven. You are my son, whom I love. With you, I am well pleased. So God knows, and also Jesus knows. Now, what's important here is you are my son, whom I love. With you, I am well pleased. It's all in the first person. There's no definitive sense that other people hear that voice, right? Because it's you. Whereas when Matthew reinterprets this, you know, takes that material and reinterprets it, Matthew says, this is my beloved son. In him, I am well pleased. And it seems like everybody else hears. But in Mark, there's this, it seems like it's very personal between God and Jesus. The other people don't hear it. Who else knows who Jesus is? The demons know who Jesus is. Okay, so these are... I think we sort of get the idea that the people who don't get it are the people who should get it, and the people that do get it are somewhat surprising. Just then, a man in their synagogue who was possessed by an impure spirit cried out, what do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are. You're the Holy One of God. Be quiet, Jesus said sternly. Come out of him. The impure spirit shook the man violently and came out of him with a shriek. So the demons get it. The demons seem to understand who Jesus is. Who else understands who Jesus is? Well, actually, we'll look at this in a second. The centurion, the pagan Roman centurion who executes Jesus, works out that Jesus is the Son of God. We'll look at that in a second. Okay, let's go back to our list of overarching themes. Now, so there's a lot of misunderstanding in Mark. A lot of people don't understand Jesus, don't get Jesus. But it's kind of unfair in a way because there's this issue that's become known as the messianic secret. In other words, Jesus seems to keep his identity secret under wraps. And it's kind of weird, really, because he keeps telling people, don't let people know who I am, you know, which just seems a really, at first anyway, I mean, you get used to it after a while when you're reading the story, but at first it's like, what? I don't get this. Let's look at some scriptures that illustrate this. In Mark chapter 3, it says, for he healed many so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. Whenever the impure spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, you are the Son of God. Bit of a giveaway, but he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him. So, you know, trying to keep it under wraps. Here's another example. When he heals people, so going back to chapter one, do we have that next one, Jeff? Yeah, a man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, if you're willing, you can make me clean. Jesus was indignant. He reached out his hand and touched the man. I am willing, he said, be clean. Immediately, the leprosy left him and he was cleansed. Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning. See that you don't tell this to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them. Instead, he went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly, but stayed outside in lonely places. Yet the people still came to him from everywhere. So maybe we could go to the next slide, Jeff, because we also get this sense from Jesus that not only is he telling people not to say stuff, but he's also apparently teaching in ways, even though people say it's amazing, he's teaching in ways that seem kind of cryptic, that seem like he's concealing something. So here's what he says to his disciples. He was saying, he who has ears, let him hear. The disciples have just been trying to puzzle through a parable of Jesus, and they don't really get it. He who has ears, let him hear. As soon as he was alone, his followers, along with the 12 disciples, began asking him about the parables. They don't get it. So what's going on? And he was saying to them, to you has been given the mystery of the kingdom of God. That word is sometimes translated the secret of the kingdom of God. But for those who are outside, everything comes in parables so that while seeing, they may see and not perceive. And while hearing, they may hear and not understand. Otherwise, they might return and it would be forgiven them. You're kind of left thinking, isn't that the whole point? Right. That people would hear and understand, that people would see and understand, that people would return and be forgiven. Jesus seems to be flipping that around now. We'll explore this a little bit as we go through the series, but and there's different theories about why is Jesus being so secretive? Or put it another way, why is Mark, the author of Mark's gospel, portraying Jesus as being so secretive? And some have said, well, it's because Jesus is trying to keep his identity secret because he doesn't want to inflame the religious authorities, the political authorities. Some would say it's reverse psychology, like don't say anything and the guy who got healed goes off and tells everybody, right? Could be that. It could be perhaps that, you know, I wonder if it's perhaps along these lines that Jesus is like, it's a little bit like with these images that we were looking at earlier. Jesus is kind of making things like a little bit out of focus so that we might lean in more. People might, and they're going to come in closer. They're going to wrestle and puzzle and try and decipher what Jesus is talking about rather than just talking things out in a very logical, obvious kind of way. Because these truths are mysterious. These truths are so weighty. Perhaps you can't just explain them in a logical kind of way. Anyway, one of the discussion questions this week asks the question, why do you think Jesus was so secretive? Be interesting discussion to have. Okay, let's get back to our list. There is a turning point in the story. And for the sake of time here, Jeff, I'm going to just summarize these next three slides, right? So we won't read them through, but I'm going to summarize what happens in chapter 8. Jesus has just performed a miracle, fed 4,000 people, and they're heading off to Caesarea Philippi, this town that was built by the Romans to house Roman soldiers. And it says, the text says they're heading off there, and the disciples are confused. They don't understand about Jesus has told them some significance about the miracle he did, and they don't get it, and they're really, really confused. And on the way to Caesarea Philippi, he says, before they're on the way to Caesarea Philippi, there's another miracle. And in this miracle, Jesus heals a blind person, and he spits in the blind person's eye and says, can you see? And the person starts seeing a little bit, but people look like trees. So it doesn't really work properly. And then Jesus looks at him intently, and then he can see properly. So it's the only example really of a two-stage miracle. And it seems to be foreshadowing about what is about to happen in the rest of chapter 8, which is the disciples, and especially Peter, have an insight, an understanding about who Jesus is. But it's only half an understanding. It's not a complete understanding. Because Jesus asked them, who do you say that I am? And some say it's John the Baptist. Some say it's Elijah. You know, so people who have come back. But who do you say I am? And Peter says, you are the Christ. You're the Messiah. And then Jesus says, don't tell anybody. Right? There's secrecy again. But goes on to say, the Son of Man, he refers to himself at this point as the Son of Man, is going to suffer and be the religious and political authorities are going to falsely accuse him and put him to death. And he'll be raised again after 3 days. And Peter's like, no way, that's not going to happen. Because Peter understands Jesus is the Messiah, but he doesn't understand what messiahship means on Jesus' terms, which is love, not power. So Jesus says, get behind me, Satan, because Peter's like, no, that's never going to happen. I'll never let that happen to you. And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. There's that battle with Satan again that we heard about at the very beginning of Mark's gospel. And Jesus says, if anyone will come after me, if anybody wants to follow me, they've got to take up their cross. Because it's all about self-denial. It's not about putting yourself first. It's not about protecting yourself. It's not about revenge. It's not about control. It's about love. And that could cost everything, but it's going to be worth it. And he uses this term, take up your cross. And of course, we know what a cross is, right? We have one up here. It's a symbol of, and we sort of celebrate it really. But back then, and Jesus has not been crucified yet, back then the cross meant one thing, and that meant brutal execution at the hands of Roman power. That's what it meant. And so Jesus is talking about taking up your cross. It's just shocking. It's awful. And it sort of leads us into this next point about the overarching themes, the narrative things. The Messiah is one who suffers for the sake of love. The Messiah is one who suffers for the sake of love. And that prediction of Jesus' death is one of three predictions that he makes. that he's going to die. And the disciples still don't get it. So they continue in their misunderstanding. They've kind of got that he's the Messiah, but they don't understand what messiahship means. And so Jesus goes to Jerusalem. And in fact, six chapters out of the 16 are devoted to Jesus's time in Jerusalem. It's called the Passion narrative, passion meaning suffering in this instance. And some have called Mark's gospel a passion narrative with a very long introduction, because it's like the death of Jesus is really what hangs over the whole story. Six whole chapters. So, you know, over a third of the book is devoted to the last week of Jesus's life. And in that last week of his life, he's abandoned, betrayed. His friends deny him. Even Jesus himself seems confused at times or full of angst. He pleads in prayer with God to relieve him of the suffering he's about to go to. Three times he does it. But then says, not your will, but my will, not my will, but your will be done. So submits to it. Even on the cross and in his trial, but especially on the cross, Jesus is silent. You take Luke's account of the death of Jesus, and we sort of conflate the different gospels together inappropriately, I think. We do that with the things like the Christmas story, the crucifixion, etc. Because in Luke's gospel, there's three sayings from the cross. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Today, you will be with me in paradise. He says it to the thief on the cross, or one of the criminals being crucified with him. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, when he dies. We looked at all of those during Lent this past year. In Luke's gospel, Jesus is a horrible death, but Jesus seems kind of aware of what's happening, aware of what the end's going to be, aware of resurrection, seems to be in control to some degree. Whereas in Mark's gospel, both thieves, both criminals hurl insults at him. There's no positive response from either of them, as recorded in Luke. And then Jesus says nothing on the cross until the moment before he dies, where he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And there's this horrible death. And it feels almost like Jesus is confused at the end. And we're gonna get into all these issues as we reach those parts of the story, right? So I'm just trying to whet the appetite, hopefully. But when Jesus dies, two things happen. We'll look at the passage that articulates this. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Interesting literary device here, because do you remember when we read the baptismal story at the beginning? It says the heavens were torn. Schizo is the word in the Greek. Only two times it appears in the whole of the gospel. At the beginning, when the heavens are torn open, and at the end, when the temple is torn in two. There's significance to that temple curtain being torn in two, which we'll get into when we get there. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, in other words, saw how sacrificially he died, how lovingly he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. So that issue of Jesus, the Son of God, at the beginning, gets the person who actually gets it, the first person to call Jesus the Son of God, is the Roman executioner, the pagan executioner at the end. It's a surprise, right? And here's an even bigger surprise, because Jesus is buried, and then on the third day, the women go to the tomb, and we get that story in other gospels too. But here's what it says. They show up, and there's a young man there in white, dressed in white. You know, we're not told, but possibly an angel. Don't be alarmed, he said. You were looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he's going ahead of you into Galilee. So this time, it's like, go tell everybody, right? It's not keep it a secret. Go tell everybody. And here's what they do. There you'll see him just as he told you. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. The end. That's the end of the story. That's the end of the story. Seriously. Now, there are a bunch of other verses that got added on much later, centuries later, because the early Christians thought, you can't have an ending like that. It's obvious somebody did say something, because we all found out, right? So, but here's a brilliant ending. Just as it starts really abruptly, it ends abruptly. And I think we have to take this as the legitimate ending of Mark. And really what's happening here is it's like, we're left, what? It's like when the credits go up on a movie, you weren't expecting it to end. And what Mark is doing is saying, what do you think? Jesus has gone to Galilee. Jesus has gone ahead of you. Are you going to pursue Jesus? Are you going to pursue this mystery? What do you think? Are you going to pursue the risen Christ? Is Christ risen? I mean, it's begging all sorts of questions. And those are questions that we're going to explore as we go through this series. So what can we take from today? We'll wrap up here. So if the band could come up, and we'll take communion together. Here are some things I think we could take today. And we're going to have communion in a moment. Communion is a time when we remember Jesus. And we especially remember Jesus' death, because Jesus had this kind of meal with his followers before he died. And it's also an opportunity for us to reflect and just take a moment of quiet. And there's lots of different ways we can do that. And I'm not going to go through them all. Many of us will be familiar with them. If we're not familiar, in the flyer you got, it will just sort of list out things you can do at the different stations around the room. So please do take this moment. But here's what I think we could take from today and carry with us as we go through this series as a whole. Jesus is a mystery to be pursued and deciphered. What we think about Jesus now may not be necessarily all there is to think about Jesus, right? And what we might think about Jesus now, what we understand about Jesus now, might even be wrong, or partly wrong and partly right. Jesus is a mystery. And here's the thing, I think, beware the presumptuousness of being an insider. The people who don't get Jesus, if you were reading this text in the first century, the people who don't get Jesus are the people who have kind of started this movement and are leaders in this movement in the story, right? And there's this irony, which we'll explore, where Jesus flips it around. It's like, if you think you're an insider, if you think you get it, be careful, because maybe you're not, your vision, your understanding isn't quite as complete as you may think. What we see here, or what Mark is showing, telling, and asking us, is a total redefinition of messiahship, right? Total redefinition. And that redefinition is based on the reality that only love can win the day. It's like Jesus is not just coming to fix a few things here and there and make a few people's lives a bit better. It's like Jesus is diving into the stenching reality of everything that seems rotten about humanity and redeeming it and transforming it in this amazingly powerful way. And only love can do that. And, based on that, if you are a follower of Jesus, so if this is us, it's the first century readers, it's people through the ages. If we're truly following Jesus, then we should probably expect suffering. Because the way of love means sacrifice. The way of love means sometimes getting totally abused. And Jesus was willing to do that, willing to persevere in the way of love. And I think that's a source of encouragement to people who are suffering. Like, if your life's not going the way that people think it should, you're in good company. You're in good company. If you're doing the right thing, but it's costing you, then you're in good company. And so this is an incredible encouragement to people, I think, who are struggling, who are suffering, especially in the time when this was written, but for us today as well. So let's just sit with these things. Again, we're going to take a moment to have some communion to reflect together. I'm going to pray, and then please come forward. You can have the fruit juice and gluten-free crackers together at the front or the middle, or you can just take them back on your own to your seat, whatever feels most comfortable for you. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, if we think of the great heroic stories of antiquity, Odysseus and Aeneas and all these incredible stories, then your story is the most incredible story, story of love. Story of redemption, a story of healing. I pray, God, as we go through this series, that story would resonate in our hearts. It would sink deep into our hearts like a seed that can give birth to something beautiful, something powerful in love. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.